State officials discuss a flaw in the pension system for public employees. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetich, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce prepares us for the upcoming Democratic Convention. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry tells us about the Student Assistance Program. And in tonight's feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with the executive director of Main Street Uptown Butte about the Montana Folk Festival. A Montana retirement board is adjusting its rules in hopes a way can still be found to preserve a legislative fix to the public employee pension system. Triggers in the law that went into place July 1st can inadvertently eradicate in January the planned increases to the amount employees and employers pay into the system. The Public Employees Retirement Board adjusted its rules so the problem might be prevented if the courts quickly on a threatened lawsuit from retirees. The retirees argue the law unconstitutionally cuts their annual inflationary increases. If they win, it could gut the other pieces of the legislative fix. Lawmakers had asked the board to issue rules that could guarantee that at least the portion of the fix that increases contributions could remain in place.
And in other news from around the state, the House has passed a scaled-down version of a massive farm bill, putting off a fight over food stamp spending and giving Republican leaders a victory after a decisive defeat on the larger bill last month. The GOP leaders scrambled to get the bill to the floor today and gather enough votes this week after making a decision to drop a politically sensitive food stamp section of the bill and pass legislation that contained only farm programs. The plan faced opposition from Democrats, farm groups, and conservative groups. But Majority Leader Eric Cantor of Virginia navigated his colleagues to a 216-208 vote by convincing Republican members that this was the best chance to get the bill passed and erase the embarrassment of the June defeat.
Montana Democrats are preparing for their party's annual convention. This year, the Central Montana community of Lewistown is hosting the two-day event. The party will be electing officers and examining their rules. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says Democrats are also wondering if any candidates for Senator Max Baucus's open seat will announce their intentions.
Montana Democratic Party Executive Director Andrea Marcaccio says the party will be using this weekend's convention to unify, to build on the types of strategies which allowed Democrats to win big statewide races in 2012.
In addition, our legislative races are a huge priority for the Democratic Party. Our year-round legislative program is already in full effect, and we're very excited to be working up and down the tickets this year.
She believes Montanans were disenchanted by how the right wing of the state Republican Party conducted themselves during the 2013 legislature. And Governor Steve Bullock agrees with that, saying Democrats can build trust with voters by reaching toward the middle.
Really, it's important that to always remember that Montanans are fiercely independent. We don't all identify ourselves as just one party or the other, and nor does one party have all the right ideas.
The challenge is always getting folks fired up and getting folks out there excited about the political landscape.
That's Senator John Tester. When he looks at priorities, what people are going to be talking about during this convention.
Well, I think anytime you have an open U.S. Senate seat, it's a big deal.
Montana's senior Senator Max Baucus has announced he is not seeking re-election in 2014. Two Republicans are already running for the seat, Missoula legislator Champ Edmonds and former gubernatorial candidate Corey Stapleton. Montana Congressman Steve Daines also says he is considering a run. On the Democratic side, the question continues to be whether former Governor Brian Schweitzer will throw in his name. Schweitzer did not return a call seeking comment. He's been mum with the press, but has also done nothing to stop any buzz about a potential run. Senator Tester says Schweitzer is the Democrats' best chance to win that seat.
I think that, Brian's a proven commodity, been a very successful governor for 8 years.
He says the Democrats need to get a candidate soon, though. Tester thinks it would be a good idea to announce in conjunction with the Democratic Convention.
It makes for good press, and it certainly will make opportunities for press folks to show up in Lewistown, because I think there's a chance, although I don't know how real it is, that he may be announcing this weekend. Maybe announces next weekend, maybe he never announces, I don't know.
The group Draft Brian Schweitzer has been holding events around the state trying to drum up support for a Schweitzer run and raising money to give to his campaign if he does jump in. State organizer Sean Whiting says the group has spoken with Schweitzer but has no official connection to him. Whiting says he doesn't know if the announcement is coming this weekend.
I've heard in the near-term future. Relatively soon is what I've heard that a decision could be made.
Whiting believes momentum continues to build for Schweitzer's candidacy, but it hasn't been without a hitch.
This involves a politician named Brian Schweitzer. Brian Schweitzer was the governor.
That's Fox Business News reporter David Asman. His recent story claims Schweitzer set up a nonprofit political action committee in 2009, a dark money group, which funneled more than $300,000 to another political nonprofit, this time in D.C. Asman asserts both organizations were illegally operating to benefit Schweitzer's ambitions.
It seems clear that this is just a political vehicle of Brian Schweitzer who wants to run for the Senate.
These guys are playing the same sort of shell game.
Associates of Schweitzer's have denied any wrongdoing. Whiting, with the draft Brian Schweitzer campaign, does not believe it has hurt his potential candidacy. If Schweitzer's intentions are not made clear this weekend, Whiting does not think the former governor is waiting too long.
There still are nearly 500 days until the election, and there's still, I think, about 7 or 8 months until the decision deadline for our primary campaign.
The Montana Democratic Party convention is being held Friday and Saturday in Lewistown. Brian Schweitzer's name does not formally appear anywhere on the agenda. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting at the Capitol.
Officials with Glacier National Park have released the name of a 21-year-old Florida man who died in a fall while climbing a mountain in the northeastern part of the park. Park officials say the victim of Tuesday's fall was Cesar Flores Jr. of Davie, Florida. He had been working as a cook at the Mini Glacier Hotel. Park officials say Flores was climbing Apicuni Mountain with three co-workers on Tuesday morning when he fell about 1,000 feet. An initial investigation and witness reports indicate Flores lost his balance near the edge of a cliff. His body was recovered Tuesday evening.
The former lab chief at Hamilton's Rocky Mountain Laboratories, a man credited with revitalizing RML by introducing colleagues to cutting-edge microbiological study, died Monday at the age of 76. Dr. John Swanson was recruited to come to the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, Rocky Mountain Labs, in 1979 from the University of Utah. RML's Associate Director for Scientific Management, Dr. Marshall Bloom, says Swanson made a mark on the world even before his time at the University of Utah.
John had worked in New York and had become an internationally recognized authority and expert on the bacteria that causes gonorrhea. And he had applied what at that time were cutting-edge technologies of electron microscopy and was also fully informed on the relatively new techniques of modern molecular biology and modern genetic approaches to the study of bacterial diseases.
Bloom says Swanson was assigned to share his knowledge of molecular cloning, molecular biology, and protein expression with his, at the time, new colleagues. Bloom says one can't overstate Swanson's lasting impacts on RML.
And although his own work focused on the bacteria that causes gonorrhea, he generously extended his expertise and the expertise of his staff to the study of virus diseases, prion diseases, the chlamydial diseases, and other infectious agents. So that's one legacy that he left. Another really important legacy from John was that he was absolutely critical guy in terms of reviewing people's work and people's publication. He was extremely well-read, a very, very good writer and editor, and the people that worked under him became very, very good at formulating and carrying out experiments and then writing the manuscripts that came from that work.
Bloom adds Swanson was also responsible for recruiting some remarkably talented scientists to RML, some whom still work there. He says Swanson also had plenty of interesting pursuits outside of the work setting.
He became a very avid golfer. In fact, after he retired, he would go to Scotland quite a bit and purchased a place over there near the famous golf course of St. Andrews. He was also devoted to music and art and a community supporter, and I think he was one of the sustaining figures in the Bitterroot Valley for National Public Radio and Montana Public Radio. So his interests in intellectual pursuits, if you will accede that golf can also be, and croquet can be, intellectual pursuits, you know, it wasn't simply focused in science. It extended to intellectual activities outside of the scientific sphere, you know, music, art, and public radio.
A memorial service for Dr. John Swanson is being planned, but no formal announcement has yet been made.
The student assistance program doesn't involve money for school or extra study time. It focuses on helping students in something other than academics. It's a network of support groups offered through a school with focuses varying from grief to substance abuse, anger, and self-esteem, among others. The student assistance program allows an intervention prevention model. FLIAD reporter Katrin Fry has more from the Whitefish School District.
Whitefish school psychologist Robin Bissell says the student assistance program came to Whitefish 4 years ago after the high school lost a student to suicide.
Out of that, the impetus from that tragic event was administrators, counselors, myself, and some teachers sat down and said, what are we doing for students that's kind of and beyond or beyond academics? You know, how are we supporting them as whole people?
Bissell says the primary goal of SAP is intervention and prevention, but it also normalizes life.
Every one of us goes through struggles, issues, problems, mental health concerns, whatever you want to call those. And I think so much in our culture we tend to judge those and those times in our life as bad or hard or avoid or deny. But what this program does is normalize that it's okay to feel, it's okay to grieve, it's okay to walk through any of those struggles, and they're normal.
Students will self-refer to SAP at Whitefish. Bissell says they'll go into a class, tell the students about the different group meetings, and hand out a list of the types of groups which students can opt into. Some groups have specific focuses on issues like grief, drug and alcohol abuse by family members, and teen drug and alcohol use. Others cover more general issues, concerns, and worries. 15-year-old Mariah Drown is heading into her sophomore year at Whitefish and says she was having a rough time at the beginning of her freshman year.
It helped me kind of with my freshman year and understanding who better kind of sounds kind of cheesy, but who I was as a person, how I was able to handle things, and then other ways that I could expand and develop, and just kind of a way to just let out everything and realize that, you know, it's okay to break down and, you know, not always have a certain, you know, kind of image.
17-year-old Becca Weaver got involved with a grief group after she lost her father last year.
I thought it was great to be in an environment where it was okay to talk about my dad, because usually it's awkward talking to people about, you just don't want to bring it up that, you know, he passed away, so it's kind of an untouchable subject.
The group meets for an hour a week for 8 weeks. The groups are confidential. Both Drown and Weaver say the meetings started out with awkward silences.
By the end of our 8 weeks, everyone was comfortable with everyone else, and we were all invested in each other's lives. Getting to know people's story and what makes them them.
Weaver and Drown are among the first students to be involved in training as volunteers with SAP. Training for adults and the students is coming up in August. Each group has two adult facilitators. The teens will be involved by co-facilitating 1 day a week and aiding in the guidance office the other 4 days a week for credit. Bissell says these groups are not counseling, not therapy, but support.
This program saves lives and changes lives and is a profound impact on, has the opportunity to have a profound impact on the global school community.
The student assistance program started in Arizona by Cheryl Watkins nearly 25 years ago. It's expanded and been picked up in many states and has gone international. In the Flathead, Bissell says Big Fork has used the program, Columbia Falls has some people getting trained this summer, and the Kalispell School District also has individuals trained in the program. The August training runs the 12th through the 14th, and those interested can contact Robin Bissell through the Whitefish District Office. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
The American Red Cross has an emergency need for all types of blood and platelet donors. In June, the Red Cross was down about 50,000 donations, or 10%, nationwide. To help make sure the Red Cross can meet patients' needs, they encourage all eligible blood donors to make an appointment. Senior donor recruitment representative Julie Brem says they have seen a more significant decrease than anticipated this summer. Brem says contributing factors include people on summer vacation and fewer mobile blood drives.
if donations continue to stay pretty low, what tends to happen is, because the need for blood is still constant, surgeries that are not urgent or that are maybe elective could be canceled. Hospitals will need to keep enough blood on their shelves for accident victims, premature babies, you know, trauma, anything that's more urgent in nature and trauma in nature. So it really becomes an issue of just ensuring that we have enough blood to meet those patient needs and all patient needs that walk through the door at the hospitals.
She says the Red Cross needs about 700 donors a month to meet the demand in Montana.
It's impacting across the state as well. We've seen it across the state with fewer people donating.
She advises donors to come prepared.
Extra water, extra juice, probably at least an extra 5 to 8 glasses that you would normally drink.
To make an appointment or for more information, call 406-543-6695 or visit crossblood.org.
Organizers are hoping for another huge turnout to the Montana Folk Festival, which kicks off tomorrow. They get their wish. Over 100,000 people will convene this weekend in Butte, America. In this evening's feature interview, Edward O'Brien gets a festival preview with the executive director of Main Street Uptown Butte, George Everett, who says Butte is an ideal town to host such an event.
Because there's a lot of traditions here in food and music. You know, everybody knows what a pasty is, especially thanks to Gus Chambers. And everybody knows what Irish music is that is played by people who actually, some like John the Yank Harrington, who came directly from Ireland and played music here until he was 100 years old. And we had our own traditions, but we also had a track record of outdoor events that we'd produced, Evel Knievel Days, the Montana Irish Festival. What we see in Butte, who live here, is the ethnic diversity of the people who came here from all over the world to work the mines, but also to, who were attracted by the wealth that was produced by the mines. But as a result, we have descendants of, you know, just about every country in the world living here, and we all managed to get along for the most part. And along with them, they brought traditions from their homeland, and they also carry some of those on today.
And when we talk about folk music, folk in this case, for the purposes of this festival, it's a pretty big umbrella. It includes a lot of different kinds of music. Yeah?
It's really, yeah, folk is kind of hard to define, because so many people have a strong image of folk music in the United States as being, you know, Peter, Paul, and Mary, singer-songwriters with guitars, the new Christie Minstrel, something like that.
Yeah.
But folk music is understood around the world as really what's called traditional or world music, but it has roots in traditions that are handed down by generations. And in many cases, there are people who are direct descendants of previous performers. A couple examples this year, but there has been every year. This year, Luther Allison's son, Bernard Allison, is bringing the blues to Montana. Sade Thomas, who's the granddaughter of Otha Turner, a famous fife and drum player, bringing that tradition of blues from the South. And there are many, there's young Italians who have lived in the tradition of Italian traditional folk music, Canzonette Glinconico Salentino. They'll be here to introduce people to some amazing Italian music. So it's people who are rooted in that tradition. They're not people who learned it, you know, from records or played guitar or, you know, decided they were going to sing this type of music. They're genuine standard bearers for these traditional genres.
Speaking with George Everett, executive director of Main Street Uptown Butte. And George, when we think about big Butte parties, I guess the first thing that comes to a lot of people's minds is St. Paddy's Day, which historically hasn't always been such a family-friendly event, maybe. But the Montana Folk Festival is a different breed of cat altogether.
Absolutely. It is very family-friendly. We have a family area, in fact, for children, with lots of activities for them that they'll really enjoy. But every venue is family-friendly. Children are welcome and encouraged, and we have thousands of kids on the site each year. There is beer being sold and wine for people, but they're in certain areas. There's courts for that, and people can drink in the crowd, but it's usually not where they really get out of hand. There's a lot of things going on. People are moving around, and I don't think I've seen more than a handful of drunk people on the site of the Montana Folk Festival since it started. So, but it's a lot of fun for families, a lot of things going on, and arts, crafts, family area, the folk life area, it's really an educational experience. If people can look for that, if they're looking for that, they'll find it there. There are workshops that take place throughout the weekend where the National Council for the Traditional Arts, which is still involved, they program these workshops that take musicians with the same instrument from different genres, and then they put them on a stage, and then they play a little, but they talk about their experience and how they compare and contrast the different genres of music. And sometimes those are very interesting. But it is like an academic inquiry into what traditional music is, and it's one-on-one technology transfer about these traditions of dance and music that come from all over the world and often resonate with immigrants who have, or descendants of immigrants in our state and in our country.
What does the Montana Folk Festival do for Butte in terms of your economy?
Well, from the beginning, our interest in this event was an economic one. We didn't realize we were starting something that was really culturally significant. We were more concerned of how could we bring people to Butte and have them see Butte in a different way, consider investing in the area, spending money on in their tourism activities. But it has really become a cultural event. But it still is a huge economic impact for Butte, but also for the surrounding communities where people are staying, because we only have about, now we have about 1,400 hotel rooms. But if we have as many people as we hope, about 150,000 last year, they have to stay somewhere. And there's camping, there's lodging in motels. But there, 1 year I talked to a person who stayed in a motel in Darby and drove over for the day. So they fill up the lodging, they buy gas, they buy groceries, they buy all sorts of things, retail stuff out of stores here in Butte and elsewhere. And then we encourage them while on the festival site to stick around Montana, because there's a whole lot of other places to see and lots of things to do here in the middle of the summer in Montana.
Okay, transportation. Any recommendations on getting to Butte and back this weekend?
Well, we really encourage anyone from Missoula to consider it. There's still tickets for sale on the beach bus that's coming from Adams Center. They can call or look online at grizztix.com. It's $30 a ticket. It's all day Saturday. Comes over at 9 a.m. and then goes back to Missoula at 7:30 p.m. For people who are driving, there's free parking available at the Butte Civic Center, and then shuttles run every 10 or 15 minutes or so. There's RV camping, RV parking, a lot of opportunities depending on how they're coming.
And two quick, perhaps, maybe oddball items here, smoking and pets. What should people know?
Yes. Oh, thank you for bringing that up. We have had complaints from people who think it's their right to smoke in the crowds or near the stages, and we just would appreciate it if people would be considerate of their neighbors there and just try not to overwhelm them with cigarette smoke. But also, we've had some very disappointed people who show up with dogs. We have a festival ordinance in Butte that prohibits pets from being allowed on the site except for service animals. That's even on a leash, so it's very strict. We think it's good for the animals because the large crowds are just not good for dogs between themselves or encounters between dogs and people. So we hope that people will make arrangements. We love our dogs as much as anybody, but I would never bring my dog to the festival, and I hope other people will get the word about that before they show up, because we've had some people disappointed. Animal control, they'll be on the site and they'll try to get the person to remove the dog, but if they have to, they will take it and impound the animal, and then they can go pick it up afterwards, which we hope doesn't happen, even one case of that. We really want people to have a great time and just leave their dogs in another place.
Okay, all this information and much, much more can be found at MontanaFolkFestival.com.
If anybody's more comfortable with Facebook, we have a MT Folk Fest. They can check that out and see people talking back and forth and lots of video clips. Oh, one more thing that's very, I think, interesting to people who use smartphones. This year, they can download an app, event-based app that is free to download through iStore or Google Play, or just go to eventbase.com/download. It has the full schedule right there on your phone, so when you're sitting at one venue, you can check and see what's coming up and get more detail about all the performers that way.
George Everett, Executive Director, Main Street, Uptown Butte, thanks a ton for your valuable time. Best of luck this weekend. Have a great time.
Thank you very much.
And in tonight's weather forecast for west of the Divide, tonight expect mostly clear skies with lows in the 40s. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a slight chance of showers. Highs will be in the upper 70s. For central Montana, tonight calls for partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of thunderstorms. Lows will be in the upper 50s. Tomorrow will be sunny, then becoming partly cloudy with a slight chance of showers and highs in the upper 70s. And for southwest Montana, tonight expect mostly cloudy skies and a chance of thunderstorms with lows in the upper 40s. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies and a slight chance of showers. Highs will be in the upper 70s. And now for the editorial comments of Kit Fisher.
Montana is one of the West's iconic landscapes. This is largely due to the significant amount of public land in Montana. Over 30% of the entire state is owned by the public, featuring a diverse range of landscapes, from Glacier National Park to the CMR National Wildlife Refuge to the Beartooth Wilderness to the Helena National Forest. It doesn't take long to find a room to roam in Montana. With rod in hand, shotgun or rifle shouldered, most of us have thankfully experienced the bounty public lands provide. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service reports that each year 570,000 people participate in wildlife-related recreation in Montana. 267,000 fish, 150,000 hunt, and 402,000 participate in wildlife watching activities. From our earliest days in the field, when any body of water or forest held unseen potential, to our current, often thoughtfully planned excursions, public lands have always been there to provide opportunity. This sporting heritage is hard to quantify on a personal level. The value of days spent afield alone or with great friends and family transcends material possessions. The value of public lands, however, can be quantified. The National Wildlife Federation's new report, Valuing Our Western Public Lands, Safeguarding Our Economy and Way of Life, illustrates the value and scope of our western lands and sends a clear message that these lands define the American landscape and our national identity. The bulk of the vast open spaces are in the West, where they have generated jobs and revenue from commodity production, tourism and recreation, including hunting and fishing. As the western economy changes from one dominated by natural resource production to one distinguished by knowledge and service-based industries, conserving public lands, especially in the face of climate change, becomes increasingly important as a magnet for businesses and employees seeking a high quality of life. The next generation of anglers and hunters are relying on today's sportsmen to conserve fish and wildlife habitat so they have the same opportunities to recreate on public lands. Several recent studies and surveys within the report found that many communities near public lands managed for conservation and recreation report higher levels of economic, population, and income growth and higher property values. The outdoor recreation industry, including fishing and hunting, contributes nearly $650 billion to the U.S. economy and supports more than 6 million jobs. Western public lands provide recreation for people from across the country and world. In Montana, outdoor recreation produces nearly $2 billion annually in retail sales and services. Americans invest nearly $39 billion annually in natural resource conservation, resulting in more than $93 billion in direct economic benefits. Extractive, commodity-based industries generate needed materials and energy and provide jobs and revenue, but have been cyclical and have become a smaller part of the overall economy. Quality habitat and unspoiled backcountry are essential to maintaining fish and wildlife habitat. Through the NWF report, a picture of the changing West emerges. Studies show that many communities near public lands managed for conservation and recreation report higher employment, growth, and income levels, and higher property values. The service industries, which include health, finance, and legal jobs, have diversified the economy and sustained communities when commodity-based industries experience downturns. By conserving the cherished lands that drive economic growth, Montana's and our national and state economies will be healthier and more sustainable for generations to come. As a sportsman from Montana, I have fished from Alaska to Florida, Baja to Oregon, and many parts in between, almost exclusively on public lands. With GPS units and even smartphones, accessing our public lands is easier than ever before. You may be surprised when you start doing your homework that running out of new places to explore in Montana is nearly impossible. Certainly, there is a place for the magnificent private land opportunities in North America. But for the common man, nothing beats the landscapes his forefathers created. Montana's James and Granville Stewart and Lee Metcalf, to name a few, and paid for with his tax dollars, equipment purchases, and license fees, and which is waiting with open arms for him to conserve for his children and the generations to follow. If you care about this Montana heritage, your access to public lands and wildlife, and your ability to share this with your children and grandchildren, as Montanans, we must continue to protect and cherish our public land resource and keep Montana the last best place. This is Kit Fisher with the National Wildlife Federation. Thanks for listening.
Kit Fisher is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.